According to town lore, Buster McCaffrey was born on New Year's Day. His mother, a slight 19-year-old Mormon girl from Monticello, Utah, left her folks to run off with a Jack Mormon, one who had lapsed in his faith and broken from the church. McCaffrey Pear was said to have worked for the Atomic Mines Corporation. This was 1987, and by then the mine was over 45 years old, requiring the miners to go down 2,000 feet to work a seam. Sheriff Dutiville was never able to gather a complete picture of the man. Some said he claimed to have worked at the famous El Dorado uranium mine in Canada. Because of this experience, management put him on a jackleg percussion drill. A co-worker vaguely remembered a guy named Tom McCaffrey as a complainer that he hadn't been on the job more than a week before he started saying the mine tunnels were narrower than what he was used to up in Canada, and the place was giving him claustrophobia. One of the muckers, the people assigned to slushing the blasted rock and ore from the stopes and bringing them up the chutes to the main haulage way, remembered a new guy, he believed his name was McCaffrey, being assigned to a miniature diesel bulldozer, 6 feet long and 4 feet wide. The muckers were paid less than drillers, but on the bright side, they got to sit on their asses all day. One of the old-timers said he recalled a story about a guy, was it McCaffrey? Asleep on his dozer, not 50 feet from where the blasting crew put a charge of Tovex in the hole. After the blast, this fellow, McCaffrey, had the brass to tell the supervisor that fumes from his diesel had stultified him. He blamed the Atomic Mines Corporation's lack of proper ventilation, once again citing the El Dorado mine in Canada as the paragon of mining procedure. Management asked Sheriff Dutiville to run a background check on him. When it came back, Sheriff Dutiville said that McCaffrey wasn't who he said he was. There had never been a McCaffrey on the payroll at the El Dorado mine in Canada, and his social didn't match. Concerned that he might be a troublemaker or a rank malingerer angling for a free ride in workman's comp, the Atomic Mines people instructed Sheriff Dutiville to escort him off the property. Dutiville recorded in his journal that he waited for him at the main gate the next morning, but McCaffrey never turned up for work. He learned that McCaffrey and his wife had bought a little piece of land up on Lame Horse Mesa. This was when you could still get it for cow pies, and headed over there to tell him he was fired for falsifying his application. He found the McCaffreys living in an abandoned sheepherder's wagon. Sheriff Dutiville knocked on the tiny rickety door. The missus came out and said McCaffrey was gone. Where did he go?
Didn't they tell you?
She said, tearing up. According to Sheriff Dutiville, Mrs. McCaffrey broke down and said that her husband had come home from work the day before with bad news. There had been an accident at the mine. He had been exposed to a deadly level of radiation. She said the doctor at the mine gave her husband 1 week to live. Even worse, he said there was a 90% chance he would contaminate their unborn child if he were to stay with them, in as close quarters as theirs. She suggested that they move and get a second doctor's opinion, but he wouldn't hear of it. There was no time or money. No, the only thing for him to do, in everyone's best interest, was to leave. Were any of the other men exposed as he was? No, he said. But then none of the other men had stood up to the corporation and complained about the unsafe mining conditions either. Had management tried to kill him? Who knows? I'm dead anyway, he answered. He asked that she put a change of his clothes in his rucksack and hand it to him through the window with some of the money from the coffee can. With much hand-wringing and tears, off he went to die at the Miners' Hospice in Grand Junction. After telling the tragedy to Sheriff Dutiville, she apologized for not offering him a cup of tea or coffee and asked why he had driven all the way out there. Dutiville was momentarily flummoxed. There was no use at this point telling her that her husband had been fired. He excused himself, saying that there was something in the patrol car that Atomic had asked that he give her. Sheriff Dutiful had just been to the First Bank of Vanadium, exchanging parking meter coins for paper money. He put the bills in a plain envelope and wrote Atomic Mine McCaffrey on the front of it. "He left without collecting this," he said. "Good luck to you, little lady." He handed over the money and left. The night the baby came, the Mormon girl was alone. Even if there had been a phone in the creaky sheepherder's wagon, there was no one she knew to call. Confident from her experience as midwife to countless kittens and cattle born on her parents' Utah farm, she went into labor at 4 in the afternoon. Calmly, she boiled some water and prepared clean rags for swaddling. Things went smoothly at first. She dilated. Buster's head began to appear, albeit painfully. From the mother's perspective, the baby's skull was as large as a Hopi dancing gourd, and his shoulders were as broad as the front quarters of a spring lamb. She bore down. She squatted. She used imagery, pretending he was a stubborn piece of sourdough that needed rolling out with a rolling pin. Dithered, she even tried pulling him out by his ears. But he was just too big. A buster, as it were. 6 long hours later, labor ground to a halt, with the baby hanging halfway out. To complicate matters, a storm had moved in and had blown 4-foot snowdrifts across the mesa. Buster's mother decided to go for help. She put on her overcoat and headed for the highway, walking bow-legged through the snow, with Buster hanging upside down from her body, swinging between her legs like the clapper of a church bell. Fortunately, Buster's mother was young and strong enough to plow through the snow and climb 3 barbed wire fences. There had been much conjecture in later years as to whether this had a bearing on Buster's lagging mental development. Being introduced to the world upside down for such an extended amount of time must have had an adverse effect on him, everyone said, not least because of the lifelong scar that ran along the medial section of his skull from when Mama didn't quite clear that last barbed wire fence at the highway. It was the cowboy Jimmy Bales Morgan, the only one in town sober on New Year's Eve, who stopped to help her. Vanadium's sole doctor had recently had his medical license revoked. The closest hospital was 120 miles away. The mother had lost too much blood already, and there was no time to be delicate about it. Jimmy was forced to make a decision that even a doctor would have been reluctant to make. In the back of his pickup were chains for delivering breech-birthed colts. And so, Buster McCaffrey was yanked roughly into this world, and his mother left it less than an hour later. That's how the sheriff recorded it in his journal. Jimmy, not knowing what else to do with this gigantic baby, wrapped him in a horse blanket and drove him and the body of the dead mother to the only place that was open that night, the sheriff's office. Sheriff Dutiful called Janet Poult and told her to get down to the jail immediately to do some emergency nursing. She had just had her 4th child. Her breasts were huge and still filled with milk. So much did she lactate that the sheriff's half and half and Dr. Pepper's were forced off the shelves of the office refrigerator and replaced with ball jars filled with her breast-pumped overproduction. Before long, Dutiful was able to track down Buster's mother's family, but they'd wanted no part of him. His mother had been shunned. To her kin, she no longer existed. Therefore, Buster didn't exist either. That's how the sheriff recorded it. The only thing left was to give the girl a proper burial. The county paid for the service and named Buster a ward of the court. Jimmy Bales Morgan wanted to keep him for his own, but the Women's League of Vanadium would not hear of it. Buster was no stray calf, dog, or crippled chipmunk that had limped into cow camp. He was a human being, they said, and more importantly, a Christian, despite his dubious pedigree. Besides, Jimmy Bales Morgan was a rough character and a blasphemer to boot. And so, the town set out to find Buster a good Christian home. Chapter 2. Adopted by the Dominguez Family. Buster's mother was buried on a sunny January day at the Lone Cone Cemetery. The storm that caused her death was long gone. In fact, all the roadside snow had already melted, and it now looked as if the storm had never happened. Mrs. Poult brought Buster to say a final goodbye before showing him off to local prospects for adoption. Serving as official breastfeeder was beginning to show its wear and tear on poor Mrs. Poult. It was virtually impossible to get Buster to give up a sore nipple once he'd clamped on. Mrs. Poult would be forced to pinch Buster's nostrils together, making him gag for air while she switched him off to the auxiliary. Once, when she'd fallen asleep while nursing, she awoke to discover the breast that Buster had been suckling had been reduced to the size of a zucchini, while the other one was still the size of a 4-H winning eggplant. After the last shovelful of dirt had been thrown on his mother's coffin, Buster was passed around to interested parties. Everyone agreed that he was a nicely behaved baby of sanguine temperament. Jimmy Morgan looked on grumpily as Adita Dominguez held Buster over her head and jiggled him until a long strand of drool ran from his mouth down into the head of her eldest son, 10-year-old Cookie. From the expression on his face, one could gather that he was none too happy to acquire a new brother, although perhaps it was too soon. It had been only 3 months since his last baby brother suffocated mysteriously in his crib. Mrs. Dominguez, on the other hand, was thrilled to tears as she hugged Buster and looked entreatingly to the Vanadium Women's League for approval. They gave it. Mrs. Dominguez was a cantante. The cantantes were a famous Hispanic family who, some people said, lived in Vanadium before the Indians used the area as a respite from the brain-cooking heat of sleeping Ute Mountain. When the whites came, the cantantes were able to coexist peaceably with them because they had nothing the whites wanted. The cantantes did not compete with them for grazing land, for they raised no cattle. Nor were they involved in the early contretemps between the cattlemen and the sheepmen, for they herded no sheep. They already had a trade, one that had been passed down through generations. They were tile makers. Their work could still be found on every countertop and in every restroom in Vanadium. They manufactured their products at their 10-acre homestead and were particularly famous in tile circles for their negrita, a small black octagon which received its distinctive lustrous ebony patina by way of a long-held family secret. The tiles were kilned under layers of sheep manure. The cantantes were the first Vanadians to keep books and have a bank account. During the Great Depression, they were the first to supply food and clothes to the needy, even to the Indians. The cantantes were the first to use a lawyer instead of arson and firearms to resolve a business conflict, the first to suggest a tax to provide schooling for Vanadian children, and the first to suggest having a lawman who was responsible for keeping the peace in the town. Adita Cantante was the first woman to be elected president of the Vanadian Rotary. She was also the head of the PTA and the Library Association. To their faces, the Cantantes were respected, but to their backs, Vanadians distrusted them. They were suspicious of their success and their ability to handle money. Some people said the Cantantes were Muranos, secret Jews hiding from the Spanish Inquisition, in spite of the fact that they wore conspicuous crucifixes and attended Catholic Mass 3 times a week. That's why the family always felt they had to try a little harder. They drew the line, however, with the first serious man to court their eldest daughter, Edita Teresa, Buster's new mother. Carlito Dominguez had been a drifter and a small-town Romeo when he met the zoftig and serious-minded Adita. He was quick to size up her family's influence in the area. Likewise, her father, Jorge, and his brother Guillermo were quick to size him up as a loser, devalued further by the mestizo cast to his features. Needless to say, they disapproved of the match. Editha, they said, you don't have to marry the first man you meet.
Why not?
Why not indeed? After all, who was she to meet in this county of Anglos and Indians? Dominguez was the first Hispanic to come to Vanadium in a long time. There was no telling when the next one would breeze through in an emerald AMC Gremlin. In the end, her family would be worn down by her mopiness and her silence around the dinner table. They agreed to let them marry. Despite their nagging reservations, they took Dominguez in and taught him the family business. Then he was found, soon after the nuptials, drunk at the High Grade, Vanadium's only cafe and bar, bragging about how much money his new family had. Guillermo Cantante, Edita's uncle, dosed Dominguez's tequila with a maggot he'd harvested from a 2-week-old roadkill. That night, Dominguez ran a fever of 107 degrees and dry vomited and shat for 11 hours straight. When the concerned Edita stepped out of the room to empty his chamber pot, Carlita was given some friendly advice. He was told he was never to drink and talk about the family's money again. After that, he didn't. And when Carlito was found having an affair at the Geiger Motel with a divorcee who worked at the cooling and heating store, once again, Uncle Guillermo stepped in. A large and powerfully built man, he grabbed Dominguez through the window of his truck before he could pull out of the parking lot and drove him to a far-out location on Lame Horse Mesa. There, Guillermo staked him 5 feet from a red ant's nest and painted his genitalia with clover honey. When Guillermo returned 3 hours later after meeting friends in town for coffee, Dominguez's bitten member had already swollen to the size and color of a Chinese emperor's koi. Once again, Uncle Guillermo gave him some friendly advice. Don't be unfaithful to Edita. After that, he wasn't. Years passed and the old Cantantes eventually died off, leaving Dominguez as head of the family. His ascension to the tile throne was soured by a daily reminder of his treatment at the hands of the Cantantes. His son Cookie, by some cruel genetic twist of fate, had grown into the spitting image of his old nemesis, Guillermo Cantante. Enter Buster. He went from being an orphan to the center of attention with his 3 brothers and 2 sisters. Cookie, the eldest, did not take part in the joy of having a new baby in the family. Instead, he observed from the shadows. While technically still a child, Cookie already had the personality of a dyspeptic adult, soured on the world. He was scary-looking to begin with. Even before he got diabetes, even before he was on his own and became bloated and puffy from alcohol, cheese sticks, and TV trays of banquet fried chicken, his eyes, 2 malevolent drips of Bosco, looked swollen shut in a wince of unspeakable pain. Pain that, when the time was right, Cookie Dominguez would make sure the world came up with the balance due. One day, completely out of the blue, Cookie asked sweetly if he could feed the baby. Edita was heartened by his request, pleased that Cookie had finally accepted his new little brother. Patiently, she instructed Cookie on how to lift Buster into his high chair, how to tie the bib around his neck, and make up his little food tray with a little dab of mashed peas, applesauce, and pureed carrots, and how much food he should put on the spoon. Then she put the spoon in Cookie's hand and stood back with her hands in her hips, waiting for Cookie to begin. He put the spoon down. "What's wrong?" she said.
"I want to feed him by myself."
"Can't I stand here and watch Boyito?"
"No."
"Why not?"
"I want to be alone with him."
Edita hesitated. Her initial reflex was to say no, the loss of her last baby still haunting her.
"Well, what's it gonna be?" Cookie said. "I don't have all day."
But then she thought perhaps it was time to lay her fears to rest.
"All right, Cookie. If you think you can do it by yourself, I'll be in the next room."
He waited with his hands at his sides until she left. Edita stood and listened before setting to work at the ironing board where a 3-foot pile of Dominguez's shirts awaited. She turned off the iron steam function to better hear. It was quiet in the next room, so she began to iron. A few minutes had passed when she thought she heard a choking sound. Or was it a baby chortling? She stopped and cocked an ear. No, that was choking. She threw the iron down and ran to the kitchen where she saw Buster, red-faced and desperate, trying to put his fingers in his mouth to clear his throat. His brother, meanwhile, sat impassively across from him, doing nothing. Editha pushed Cookie out of the way and quickly yanked Buster from his high chair, laid his stomach across her knees, and began pounding his back. No good. She sat him up and performed what she could remember of the Heimlich maneuver that she had seen in a restaurant. Two violent contractions of her fists in Buster's solar plexus sent the obstruction flying from his windpipe across the room where it smacked against the wall. Now, being able to breathe, Buster managed to laugh and playfully reached lovingly for his brother's face, but Editha held him tightly to her hip. At first glance, the object that Editha found near the wall looked to be a Hershey's kiss. In that scenario, Cookie, out of affection for his brother, imprudently gave him a piece of the hard-to-swallow candy. On closer examination, however, the object in question turned out to be a moving piece from the family's popular board game. Sorry, Cookie taunted, as if playing the game. How did he get this? Editha demanded. How the fuck should I know? Editha slapped him so hard, she turned his face sideways like a movie stuntman's. Can I give him a bath?
Go to your room!
How was it possible? All of her children were raised the same way, given the same amount of attention, and yet, while the others were thoughtful and obedient, helpful around the house, even talking about the colleges they wanted to attend someday, Cookie was pen pals with a man by the name of Richard Ramirez, who Editha later learned was a serial killer on San Quentin's death row. She expressed her misgivings regarding Cookie's moral turpitude to her husband, since he spent more time alone with Cookie than anyone else.
Entender algo. I am not his father.
His father is the devil. It was clear that Buster's security would rest solely on Editha's shoulders. To her husband's growing frustration, she moved the baby's crib into their bedroom, where it stayed for 4 years. During the day, while she cooked, did the laundry and the vacuuming, Editha carried Buster in a sling on her back. She bore him in this fashion until he weighed nearly 60 pounds, it having the welcome side effect of correcting her congenital scoliosis, a doctor in Denver told her would never improve without surgery. When Buster was finally placed on the ground, he was only allowed to play with his sisters. They fussed over him, cornrowing his red hair and dressing him in their clothes. This went on until he was 8, despite a constant barrage of sissy name-calling by Cookie. Buster's sequestration with his sisters came to an end when he was 10, and already a foot taller than Cookie, who was a paddle-footed, squat, and corpulent 19. Still somewhat fearful, Editha felt Buster was now physically capable of protecting himself.
I'm thinking of letting you play with your brothers.
Okay.
But you have to be very careful around your brother Cookie.
Why, Mommy?
Something is wrong with him.
Up here,
she said, tapping her temple with a finger.
I'm awful sorry.
Don't be sorry.
Just careful.
Her warning delivered, Buster was released into the company of his brothers. The younger ones were delighted. Maybe they would no longer be on the receiving end of the games Cookie invented for them to play. In those games, the younger boys played the role of hapless law enforcement to Cookie's sadistic criminal mastermind. No matter how hard hapless law enforcement tried, they always wound up crying.
You know how to play DEA, man?
Cookie inquired of Buster.
Nope, I sure don't.
Well, you're gonna be the DEA man. He's the man with the badge.
Gosh, thanks.
In the game of DEA man, Cookie and his younger brothers had to move several 5-pound bags of tile glaze around the compound and keep it hidden from Buster, who was the green agent sent to the West from Washington, D.C. There wasn't much more to the game than that. The fun part for Cookie was when Buster discovered the drug cache. He would then jump him or descend from a rope somewhere and employ different faux martial arts moves. Unfortunately, the bullets in Buster's imaginary government-issued sidearm had no effect on Cookie. Buster endured being karate-chopped and flipped on his head too many times to count, but he never complained nor tattled on him. When Fridays rolled around, the Dominguezes would load all the kids into the back of the truck for a drive into town. Buster liked to sit above the rear fender of the pickup with his nose in the wind like a dog. All the kids had a few bucks in their pockets from chores and an idea of how they wanted to spend it, even though it always came down to the same things: candy for the boys, teen fashion magazines for the girls. Vanadium's main street had resisted paving for over 100 years, almost as if the town was holding out for the return of horse-drawn carriages. People passing through on their way to Utah drove slowly, not to enjoy Vanadium's down-on-its-heels Victorian architecture or raised wooden sidewalks, but rather to avoid potholes that were deep enough to conceal a man on horseback wearing a stovepipe hat. Dominguez guided his Dodge Power Wagon into an empty space in front of the Buttered Roll, the town's only restaurant without a bar. In those days, before Mr. Malamar came to town, Vanadium hadn't any need for more than one restaurant. The prevailing attitude was that paying for a meal outside the home was a useless extravagance. Buster could see Sheriff Dutiful in the window booth having a cup of coffee and a cigarette with a crusty-looking cowboy. They both took notice of him. In fact, they seemed to be talking about him. "Have your asses back here in 45 minutes, Dominguez said. The kids all jumped off the truck and left on their predetermined missions. Cookie lumbered out the back with the difficulty of a fat kid. It didn't help that he insisted on wearing a big woolen overcoat whenever he went to town, even in the broiling heat of summer. No one talked about it, assuming it was his sad way of concealing his weight problem. The pockets of Cookie's coat were slit on the inside to allow his hands to reach all the way through. To the proprietor of a shop, it looked like he was just standing by the merchandise with his coat open. But inside the coat, his hands were grabbing whatever he desired. Cookie alone was responsible for 75% of Vanadium's retail shrinkage. It was time to get going. He only had 45 minutes. His parents insisted they be back at the house on Fridays by sunset. He started walking off by himself, then noticed Buster.
"Hey, fuckwad, come with me."
Happy to be included, Buster followed his brother into the hardware store. Cookie made a cursory inspection of plumbing supplies, power sanders, fuse boxes, rat traps, and poison. He wasn't really interested in any of that. He knew the owner of the store was watching him and that diddling around long enough would tax the proprietor's attention span. When he saw him go back to reading his paper, Cookie headed to the real object of his desire: a pyramid of .22-caliber ammunition in the gun department. Dominguez had, ill-advisedly, given Cookie a single-shot J.C. Higgins rifle without ever bothering to ask why it seemed he always had an unlimited supply of ammo for it. Cookie opened his coat and slipped a few boxes into his shirt, then hissed at Buster.
"Get over here, moron."
Buster came over and stood next to him.
"Unbutton your shirt." "Gosh, why?" "Just do it, numbnuts."
Cookie stuffed two more boxes of .22s into Buster's shirt.
"Okay, follow me, not too fast. Stop and look at some shit like you're shopping."
Buster took him literally, and on the way out stopped to stare at some bags of steer manure. Cookie looked at him sang froid.
"Si no eres el idiota más idiota que conocido."
When the 45 minutes were up, everyone returned to the truck that was already loaded with groceries.
On the way out of town, a truck that had the logo of a contractor's company on the door panel pulled up beside the Dominguez's. The person on the passenger side of the moving truck rolled down his window.
Hey, Dominguez. The boss wants to redo the floor of the Vanadium Hotel lobby.
Tell them to call you at the office, Edita said nervously.
She didn't like this kind of communicating on the highway. Dominguez ignored her.
How many square feet?
He yelled back to the men, further aggravating her. While this mobile business meeting was being conducted in the back of the truck, Cookie cornered Buster.
Let's have them. Have what? The shells we boosted, gringo?
I put them back.
You what?
If I'd have kept them, that would have been stealing.
Cookie wanted to throw him off the truck, but he knew he couldn't lift him. Instead, he grabbed Buster's cowboy hat from his head and angrily frisbeed it into the back of the truck conducting the business conference at 40 miles an hour alongside them.
Hey!
His other brothers pretended not to see it, but Buster's sisters immediately came to his defense.
That was mean, they both said. Mommy gave me that hat for cleaning the house. So go get it if you want it so fucking bad.
Buster looked at his hat fluttering around on the back of the adjacent pickup truck.
Better get it now while you still have a chance, Cookie taunted.
Cheeky, cheeky, brook, brook.
Buster's brow furrowed. Feebly, he tried to calculate the physics of this. Could he do it? Could he jump from the back of one moving truck to another?
Don't do it,
his sisters pleaded.
Shut up, you little cunts. If he wants it so bad, let him jump for it.
Buster did not want to see his hat right away. He put one foot on the side of the truck and braced one hand on the top of the cab, where inside his foster parents sat unaware.
All right, the passenger of the other truck said to Dominguez. See you tomorrow at 10:30.
The contractor's truck started to accelerate away.
Don't do it!
Buster's sister screamed. Buster had already waited too long when he jumped. He missed the side of the passing truck, but managed to get his hands on the tailgate. Unfortunately, his long legs reached the road, the tips of his cowboy boots burning from the friction. Inside the Dominguez's truck, Edita and Dominguez were too busy arguing to notice Buster being dragged past them.
Do you have any idea how dangerous that was, what you just did? There is such thing as a telephone, you know.
Shut up.
You have children in the truck, she said, wanting to have the last word.
Now smoke began to billow into their windshield from the truck in front of them. I think he blew his rings. I better catch up and tell him.
Dominguez sped up, and as they drove through the smoke, he and Edita were able to see Buster hanging by his fingertips, his boots on fire.
How the hell?
Dios mío!
Edita cried. Dominguez sped up and began honking his horn.
In the meantime, Buster's higher mammalian instinct for self-preservation overcame his fool's insubordination and commanded all the strength of his tall, skinny frame to pull himself up. Slowly, his feet came off the pavement where the friction had already erased the points in his cowboy boots and the tips of his socks. Shaking and trembling at every juncture of muscle and tendon, Buster managed to get himself up on the rear bumper. He waited a moment to catch his breath, then flipped himself over the back tailgate. Gone from view momentarily, he suddenly sprang to his feet, triumphantly waving his hat. All of this took place without the knowledge of the driver and passenger of Buster's current vehicle. Loudly singing along with Reba McEntire's Is There Life Out There on the radio. After they recovered their wayward passenger, Dominguez pulled over and interrogated the children in the back of the truck.
Who let him do that?
Dominguez stood waiting for an answer. Cookie remained silent. The younger brothers cast their eyes to their laps. Finally, Dominguez looked to his little daughters. Surreptitiously, one of them pointed a teensy-weensy finger in the direction of Cookie.
You little cuck,
Dominguez said to Cookie, cutting off the obscenity. Cookie just smirked at him. There it was, the dismissive expression of Guillermo Cantante. Dominguez balled his fist. He wanted to slam it into that insolent fat face of his, but he could wait.